Well, hi everybody, it's Toby Miller here from the Cultural Studies Podcast. You can follow my misadventures at tobymiller.org. And I'm here for a second podcast with people from Peace Action West, a wonderful association that I've got minorly involved with. In the first podcast we did with some people from this Peace Action West group, we spoke with folks who were involved mostly in the Bay Area, which is the head office, I guess. Is that right, guys? Yeah. In the policy field and also the finance field. My first interaction with Peace Action West was via a street canvasser, a person who approached me on the street and said, "You look like you might not be a gun-toting fascist. Can we please have some money?" No. That may not have been precisely the way in which she addressed me, but I
took
that.
Essence.
That's the essence of it, exactly.
Is that right?
So, no,
we might.
It's definitely one for attracting attention to people getting on the bus, right? And I'm here with three people who are very involved in that kind of canvassing, and they have very distinctive backgrounds. And I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves just quickly to you, Francis, Jonathan, and Paul, and just share a little bit of their experiences, but also get them to reflect both on that grassroots street-level organizing and how it relates to anti-war activities, to the policy process, and so on. Because for me, there's in an area like this, there has to be a continuum between the street and K Street, if you like, between what in the United States. I should say that 50% of people who download the podcast are based in the US, but 10% of the people who actually occasionally download a podcast are in the US. So we've got a lot of people outside California, a lot of people outside the US context, 75 different countries represented in visits to the site. So one needs, it's great to be local and specific, but it's also great to assume we have plenty of non-English first language speakers and plenty of folks who won't know what K Street is, i.e., by the way, for those listening, that's the principal area rhetorically for lobbying in DC. And the reason I mentioned it is to say there's a link between K Street as an elite place where big money determines how policy is made and programs are implemented in this country, and the street, as in where all of you are actively working. So maybe we could just go round the table and get you to say your name, what you do in the organization, yada yada. Paul's been identified as the first victim.
I'm Paul Shirey, and I've been with the organization for right on 4 months, I think, at the end of this week. And I'm currently working as the trainer, which consists of, at this point, first week, and when we have new canvassers coming in, the first week I more or less handle them. So the day one, we work on the grab, we work on essentially...
The grab,
which is what you proposed there, right, which was the whole idea. You look like you're not a gun-toting fascist. You might be able to have... That would be a really clever grab. We typically stick with, especially in the first couple of days, a more stock grab, help stop the war in Afghanistan, we're pressuring Congress, and the like. And a lot of what we essentially, on the street do on a day-to-day basis is connect on that individual level. So when I'm doing the grab in the first day training, really what I'm telling people is it's not even about what you say. It's not the organization. It's about that eye contact, that smile, that connection you make between you and this stranger on the street. And that's really what we're all about, is that connection.
And the young woman who grabbed me, as it were, in that way, was exactly of that ilk. Smiling, happy, friendly, not being moralistic or critical, just, we've got an important position and we'd love to know what you think of it. So, Jonathan?
Hi, my name is Jonathan Ritter. I am a field manager with Peace Action West. So basically, throughout the day, I will check in with the different canvassers, see how they're doing, do everything in my power to keep their energy up, and use different training techniques, different other ways of, keeping people in high spirits, keeping those smiles on people's faces naturally and organically.
Yeah.
And, bring in new members, and basically, in charge of the team when they're out there on the field.
So you're the anti-burnout machine.
I am the anti-burnout machine, and I get burnt out very easily.
Right, and you get burnt out,
but it's good
out,
times, and I have a good time doing it, and it's all about, getting people involved, so that a lot of that keeps me going. People like yourself who want to see these changes happen.
And Francis.
And I am Francis Yasmin Motiwala. I've been with the organization 3 years, just over. I began as a canvasser, but quickly moved up to be the director. because there was no director before me. But basically, that what that means is that I manage the canvas, and I'm responsible for both the administrative side as well as being responsible for my own organizing as well. So I split my time within in the office and dealing with all the numbers and the data and planning and scheduling and hiring and recruiting. I've got a great cadre, a team of people to help support that work as well. And then I'm also, for 3 years, have been organizing myself and out in the field, talking to people and introducing them into this organization that I've grown to respect and love with utmost respect. Yeah.
Now, as I speak over the computer, does it look as though it's registering in terms of the little lines going up and down?
Yep, great. More than us.
Sorry. Francis, can you... I want to begin with something that many people would find boring, but I find fascinating. When you're saying you're handling the data, the numbers, what sorts of data are you looking at in your job?
So every day we track a whole range of data, starting from the number of stops a canvasser has to the number of complete wraps that they get through.
Now hold on, what's the difference between a wrap and a grab?
Okay. So the grab is basically getting in the door, is getting someone's attention, getting them to stop.
You guys are JWs. You're Jehovah's Witnesses.
I know
what's going on.
Right, we stand out on the street though.
You're not as tall, and you're not wearing the same clothing, but other than that, I can't tell the difference. Anyway, sorry.
They are a Teutonic lot. They're all
What is funny, canvassing near canvassing in Hollywood near the Scientology building, people definitely have a little
You should have a little board, you know, with
stress
a pen,
tests.
And do you like to take a test about how politically savvy and right on you are? Anyway, sorry. The wrap versus
political.
The grab.
So the first step is getting someone to stop and talk to you and identifying the issue. But people have either limited attention spans or... So to get through a full conversation with someone and actually get to the point of the conversation, get to the what we call the ask, where you're actually inviting them to join the organization, make a financial contribution, there's a difference. We call them derailers, people who will either take the conversation and steer it the other way, will just want to talk about what they want to talk about and tell you stuff instead of have a conversation and learn about the organization. Or maybe their bus shows up and they bolt before the end of the conversation. That's called the difference between a grab and an ask.
Yeah.
So we also track then the number of contributors and the number of new members. The
yes.
difference there being someone who joins as a new member, makes a contribution of a membership level, either a monthly or a one-time. Sometimes people either aren't ready or don't have the means to do that and hand you a couple bucks. We accept every dollar goes to help make it happen. But then we track our new member rate and then, how many high donors, how many sustainers we get. And basically by taking all this data, we can find some objective meaning to work on skills for various organizers. With training canvassers to do this kind of work, looking at that data, you can determine, like, if this person is getting 20 stops but has no contributors, something's falling apart in the middle of their conversation. If they're having, if they're getting a low amount of stops, they need to work on their grab. So basically, we're able to use that kind of data to help train, and that's and to do the training that Paul and John and I do, and to work with canvassers, because talking to people about politics on the street and then asking them for money is breaking all kinds of social norms in it, and it's not easy. But one thing the organization has over decades now really worked on and solidified is the ability to train people to do this work, to provide them the skills and to be effective organizers, because that conversation is as different as every conversation is, and it's a powerful moment, and it's how we're able to make change and to mobilize people to actually do something, so get involved, so it's powerful.
So in a way, this is a mixture of death of a salesman, of door-to-door selling, with the product not even being vacuum cleaners, but essentially anti-imperialism. isn't it?
Without that language, without the word imperialism.
Without ever using that language, yeah. I think.
You know, they say that if you can do street canvassing, you can pretty much sell anything.
Yeah.
My problem is, at this point, I don't think that I could actually go back to selling a thing. At this point, I'm like...
Have you done sales? Any of you? In conventional sales?
If you count the Obama campaign, I mean, that was the biggest brand in the 2000 era.
I think the answer is yes.
I was pushing a brand there. I did work on the Obama campaign.
Sorry, John, what were you saying?
I was just saying I worked at a record store when I was in high school.
Right,
the only time I've ever done any retail
sales. I worked at Starbucks,
sales.
I worked at a movie theater. I mean, I worked in places where people were coming in and expecting
anyway,
to hand me money.
And you're doing service. You've rolled on service work.
The golf industry was service work, which it's been an interlude and was the preface.
Now,
are we going to go right there?
We have to go immediately to golf, which is the core of the anti-war movement, as we
know.
It
really is.
Now, my understanding is that every Professional Golfers Association cardholder on the U.S. tour is a registered Republican, with the possible exception of Tiger Woods. But who knows?
Well, Tiger Woods made some really apolitical statement about President Obama and how great it was for race relations. I imagine just because of his tax bracket, he might be a Republican.
But the rest really are registered Republicans.
Paul Casey, who's a Brit, and he is a member of the PGA Tour, took a very strong stance against the Iraq War, which was amazing.
Did he?
In golf circles. Yeah, but that was very rare. And he's a Brit.
Yeah.
He's not.
They don't count. It's like Tony Parker in the NBA, right?
Yeah, it's a little
just
different.
Damn foreigner. Yeah. You're back where you came from, is what I say.
I can't even understand what he's saying. But yeah, I mean, one of the interesting thing, I mean, I don't know if you want me to get into it, the golf.
I do, and the next thing I want to talk about is Cheryl Cole's accent and TMZ's exposure of why she was removed from the X Factor.
I have no idea who they are.
We're running with the big topics here, but very quickly, I would be interested in the golfing thing for a moment. The point about this is that you've come from, in part, from having been somebody who was interested in becoming a pro golfer, was a pro golfer, into something that I guess I'm suggesting is very far away from that, politico-culturally, shall we say.
They really are the two aspects of my identity that have been constant since I was about 8. Even earlier with
politics. So you've kept them in tension.
Yeah, I mean, basketball was my thing. When I turned about 10 to 12, my height was such that I had to do something that was a little bit more practical. So basically for me, sports and politics have always been huge.
Yeah.
Because of circumstance, because of, you know, a late growth spurt, I was a golfer. And it kind of explains the tension that I have, because I grew up in suburbia, but my family came from a real progressive political legacy. On my dad's side, Southern populists from Texas. When they came into California, they got involved in local Democratic politics. My great-grandfather's actually the founding mayor of South El Monte. So then there's that political end, which is more establishment Democrat than I've kind of become, but it was really big in my identity. And part of that was the establishment part was golf. My grandpa was a golfer. I also loved Jack Kennedy, and it was just...
I think many people love Jack Kennedy, maybe not the same way your grandfather.
Yeah, it's a little different probably. But anyways, it essentially, out there on the golf course, that's where the tension between my politics and my suburban upbringing really came out in its strongest form. So that year I talked about in my bio, right after high school, that I worked at a golf course in the period of 9/11, right after 9/11, did more to steal my resolve to be a political actor than anything ever has, really. Working in poverty.
I'd like to ask Francis and Jonathan a bit about how they got involved in these things too, but I'd love to pick up on this. What were you hearing in the clubhouse from WASP suburbanite men? I assume that's the cohort we're discussing.
It was incredible racism. In the period following 9/11, anybody that was brown and not black or Latino essentially was an other, and they were in that terrorist category. It was just like Indian folk, you know, Indian American folks from India. Everybody that I knew that was from, you know, suburbia.
Anybody South Asian, let's say.
Yeah, South Asian, exactly. Yeah. My bad. Yeah, exactly. So South Asian. No, but I should be able to use that rhetoric. But anyways, that's essentially the way it worked. Was
bad.
Yeah.
Demerit
a lot of people that had been fully integrated. One of my best friends, Eric Pereira, was on my golf team, and he was Sri Lankan, and it was just amazing to see the reaction there with him just walking in on a day-to-day basis, the things said behind his back. Just the general terrorist label that was applied to everyone. Yeah. And also the questioning of my patriotism because I was opposing the Afghan intervention at the time, and I was being somewhat vocal about it around.
Interesting. Jonathan, could I ask you a little bit about the background that brings you to what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. I came out to Los Angeles 8 years ago in 2002 with interest in playing music and doing film and other various.
Music and film,
doing other various sorts of arts.
Weird place to come if you're interested in those things.
Yeah, I know.
Why didn't you go to Kansas? What was wrong with you?
Well, there's that pool's so filled up already, you know, that it's impossible. But, I came out here to do that, and I waited tables for a period of time as a result of that. Always definitely, like, was fascinated with politics and with foreign policy in general, specifically. And just, like...
Thank you so much.
I sort of, for a very long time, viewed it as, like, with a bit of cynicism, with a bit of, like, you know, it's entertainment, things can't be changed, continue ad nauseum. In 2008, the economy hit. The first thing to go was a lot of these service industry positions. I was one of those unfortunates. So when I was looking for other work, I stumbled upon canvassing and doing some of this political activism kind of stuff, and jumped right on the opportunity to actually, like, kind of step up and take this stuff a bit more seriously and take some of those, you know, personality skills or whatever, and put it to something more useful than getting your friends more ranch, Paul.
So can I follow up on that? That's incredibly interesting. So you had the ideological commitment, but you didn't see a way of changing things.
Absolutely.
Then you were forced by the political economy, the pervading political economy, to move into this field because you couldn't wait tables in the same way as you could do organizing.
Exactly. Right? But that was the other story. As soon as I came across...
I appreciate
across,
your frankness very much.
No problem. Yeah. But I definitely, you know, I came across Peace Action West, the internet ad for looking for organizers, and I went to the website and looked at everything that this organization had done, and it just blew my mind that, you know, there was this other avenue for making our voices heard, you know, that there was something that people could do that was more productive than protesting and blocking traffic and all that, you know, that you could actually make your voice heard in a meaningful way that actually changed policy. And it really inspired me. It really inspired me to do something more useful with myself.
No, that's great.
Fire away. I was going to say, and every day John is out there making his voice heard.
and getting other voices heard too. I should clarify, Fran said that in her intro. Both Paul and I do canvass as well.
Yeah, I didn't mention that. I canvass in addition to train. Yeah.
They lie around couches smoking pot all day.
If you can call that canvassing.
Every day I canvass, if you can call that canvassing. I don't know what you call that.
Something Paul was saying as far as being in the environment of the golf setting and sharing or having a different political opinion reminded me of my college days.
Fran wins on that one.
I grew up evangelical Christian, and when I was in high school and thinking about my college decision, I felt like the Lord wanted me to go to a evangelical Christian college, and I got accepted to Wheaton College in Illinois. My senior year of high school, though, as I was preparing to go to college, I realized in my government and democracy accelerated class with the amazing Mrs. Dinas, that I was not a Republican. And this came as a big shock to me because I'd grown up thinking that you had to be a Republican since all the other Christians in my family and church were. So I took that little bit of knowledge and I became first I thought I was a populist, but then I realized they didn't exist anymore, and so I had to be a Democrat. And then I went to Wheaton College and I majored in political science. And at a certain point I realized that I was one of maybe 20 Democrats of the 2,000 students on campus. I was one of maybe 20 Democrats. Freshman year, there was these sophomore poli-sci majors that lived across the hall from me, and this was during the Clinton Dole campaign. And there was
1996.
A serious, you know, defacing of various things on each other's dorm room doors. I remember getting chased down the hall for my political views, and sort of, I mean, I'm sure it wasn't violent because we were all good Christian kids, but there was a serious disconnect for me between my politics and the environment, the Christian environment. I attempted to found an organization on campus called the Progressives. I don't think I knew what it meant at the time. But
you know that four people turned up, right?
Well, my problem was is that I tried to make it open to everyone. And I thought, well, okay, like, you know, left and right could come together. And I thought maybe do social change work. I thought maybe, like, you know, feed homeless and whatnot. But I realized that there was, because it was so open, it was hard to mobilize in any one direction. And it just kind of became a wash. But anyway, that's really neither here nor there. I left Wheaton College and I moved to New York City, where I started to really find myself, find my own identity, discover, you know, my even sexual identity, and that I was not straight. That took me a while to recognize that, and then to learn. But actually, at that point, I shifted from politics and I steered clear from politics because I think partially I also realized that I wasn't an evangelical Christian, and the two things for me. I became apathetic about both things. Who was I to say what was right about politics? Who was I to say what was right about religion? And so I kind of recoiled from taking any firm stances on anything. And I lived my life, you know, happily enjoyed every moment, had good friends, good, you know, a good job, and
what were you doing?
I was working in book publishing. I was in the art department, both at St. Martin's Press and Little Brown and Company. Shout out to all those peeps. great times. Had an amazing, amazing 6 years. But even through that, I consider my low point of apathy on February 15th, 2003, when millions of people... including my girlfriend at the time, we're going out to march against the invasion of Iraq. And I laid in bed and cried, you know, because I was, you know, I don't know. I just felt completely powerless to actually be part of that or do anything. And then even looking at that day and seeing millions of people march and it not accomplish anything, I felt even more disempowered. Like, you know, what can we really do? The Bush administration is not listening. And again, at this point, I was unwilling to participate in politics. But at that moment, I realized, well, I hit my rock bottom. And then suddenly after that, I started encountering people through emails that were forwarded to me, like Robert Mueller, who is now the, you know, Chancellor of the University of Peace, ex-UN, and Mark Morford of the SF Gate. And their writings inspired me to start from that basic yes premise, that positivity and changing, saying yes to things.
The yes premise.
Yeah.
The getting out of bed premise.
Yeah. Positivity can change things. And so for me, it had to start at that really personal place of recognizing that I could actually take a stance on things. I could create my own positivity. I could create change in the world again. So that really spiraled for me. I started a group, as I do, called CTW, Change the World. And at that point, it was engaged. I wrote a four-page manifesto on notebook paper, and then I invited all my friends I knew in New York City to get together at a local coffee shop and meet each other, just recognizing that that would change their lives, people connecting. So I guess that's when I became, I mean,
totally
that kind of
natural in the canvassing, yeah.
That's funny, that kind of grassroots organizing. I haven't really thought about that since then.
Can I just follow up on a couple of things there, one of which is particular to you and the other of which is relevant to all of us? I know from having spoken to you when we met the other night that your parentage, if that's a word, your cultural / ethnic background is South American and South Asian, right?
Correct.
How does that percolate into even an evangelical upbringing? Do you mind? And how does that then articulate to politics?
Yeah. My father is from Pakistan. He grew up Muslim, and my mother grew up in Peru as a Catholic. When they met in America, came, you know, got married. They started attending a Lutheran church. And I guess, I mean, the story goes that they weren't having their questions answered. So one day, I remember they looked in a phone book and found a Baptist church where they ended up meeting some missionaries from Irian Jaya who taught them about the Lord. So I suppose there's this trend of being led by fate that's transcended my life too, where I'll go with the flow, I'll look in a, you know,
articulate to your parents.
The go with the flow. So that's how they found Christianity, and I just kind of went along with it, I suppose, and just feel like I was like a overachiever in whatever I was doing. So when I was at church, I just was an overachiever at that.
A type A evangelical.
Yeah, it's hard to say how. I mean, I think it's something I struggle with even today is, like, I've had someone organize with us for a year, Shauna Walker, showed up at the interview and said, God wants me to be here. And so it's hard to not hire her, right? She was amazing. She was an amazing organizer. And she and I, even though now I do not necessarily believe in God, would come at things from the exact same perspective. Like, and I can't not feel like this, we're doing God's work, because if the Bible teaches us anything, it's thou shalt not kill, you know, love one another. So I don't know, I guess I actually have no clear answer to your question, because I wouldn't say I've figured out my own personal
I think that's a great answer.
Except that they're confused.
And this is for all of you. You mentioned sexual identity, and that's been very important in the history of U.S. militarism, it seems to me. And a component, many people say, of the way that Clinton, Bush, and Obama, amongst our three last presidents, comported themselves is to do with proving a certain kind of martial masculinity.
Particularly the Democrats haven't approved that.
Particularly the Democrats, you think?
Well, just the proving part. Yeah. I interrupted you, my bad.
No, you didn't.
Oh, well, I mean, that's it. To overcome the weak on national security thing is seemed to me that, if you listen to the Democratic pundits, that's a big priority. President Obama taking out Osama bin Laden, I'm sure, or at least, you know, being involved in the process and overseeing it, it was just a dream for those mainstream Democratic types who really want to see, kind of want to out-militarize the right in a certain way by projecting that masculinity.
The reason I'm asking this, John, I'll come to you in a second if I may, is that although I was born in Britain and spent much of my life there, my father was Australian and I spent a lot of time there. When I first went there, it was a viciously white supremacist, heterosexist country. Now, the woman who is essentially the Secretary of the Environment there is an out lesbian Asian senator. All these things are inconceivable in the United States. Her deputy is the former lead singer of Midnight Oil.
Really?
Also inconceivable in the United States.
Wow.
Right? And I would never hold up Australia as a paragon of racial or sexual virtue, but it's a long fucking way ahead of where we are right now on that score. So, John, can I ask you a little bit about the masculinity question to do with not so much necessarily interpersonal violence, so that's fine too, but this collective imperial violence?
Well, I mean, I think just like ripping a little bit off of what Paul said too, you know, a lot of Democrats coming out, you know, trying to not seem weak on national security, therefore we have to make the military strong.
Yeah.
I just think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the idea and the concept of security, that the only way to continue security is through military force. You know, I mean, I personally think that specifically right now, specifically where we're engaged in wars with organizations that have no affiliation with any country, that have no affiliation with any of that kind of stuff, and we're using this old school mentality to go after them. And it's to me, it's not even a matter of masculinity or not masculinity. It's just it's not an effective solution. You know, it's not something that. It's not something that's going to work, but our government is still stuck on this old way of thinking that's just not effective, and continuing the cycle of violence. I'm not a religious person myself, but I do believe that violence begets violence. And as long as we continue this this spiral, it's going to get worse and worse and worse.
And we can actually
get more national security, more actual true national security, by looking for more peaceful, better solutions.
I kept thinking about Denis Kucinich, because one of the things was his web store, and on his t-shirt it said strength through peace.
Yeah.
And during the Cold War, and really even since, a lot of what our policy has rested on is peace through strength, right? Mm-hmm. America has a military that is formidable, can't be touched by anything else in the world. Therefore, we have the ability to bring peace to the world by essentially having so much potential power.
Yeah.
And our idea essentially is that the strength comes through the pursuit of peace. And you know, that's really what we're about, as opposed to the pursuit of strength brings about peace as a byproduct.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing, though, too, is that one of the things that conflicts people, even progressives that we talk to on the street, will be conflicted over our security, or this threat, or if we did get rid of all our nuclear weapons. People are, even progressives, are really hesitant to go that far and to trust that there could be some sort of security without our military might.
And they don't want to seem weak.
Yep.
It's amazing how often in the street I talk to a progressive who just assume that any criticism of our military might makes you weak, you know?
Now, could we get back to that street level and find out what you folks encounter when you're there? I'm fascinated by this. I'd like to follow up on this particular issue of weakness. When the day I arrived to live in the United States, regrettably, in some ways, wonderfully in others, I fell in love with someone. And, of course, it ended in tears, as these things always do. Not that I'm wishing to bring this to your lives, but... No, I haven't
Fran's
been personal,
fine.
But I mean, to
She's
me,
doing
it's,
fine.
You're right, sure.
I'm about to cry, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I know, it's very moving.
No,
but the first significant political economic discussion we had that went poorly was over my saying the United States should abandon the Monroe Doctrine and get out of Latin America and just do nothing at all. It should regard Latin America as it regards any other part of the world and simply not say this is our space. And the person I was in love with, who was very much on the left and anti-imperialist, a feminist, said, but we're the leader of the free world, we have responsibilities. I said, no one elected you that, you call yourselves that. This is the most destructive, you know, all the things you can imagine. So tell me about what happens when you're on the street and you encounter this notion, this block that says we bring security through power. Because what interests me in this is that is the mantra of international relations as a discourse, as a policy, as an intellectual construction. How does one make security and stability in the international arena in a world that is not governed by laws, it can't be, a sort of Hobbesian nightmare, right? Where we've worked out roughly how to govern states internally, but not externally, and hence it's only raison d'etat, you know, the power of the state, that can generate specific outcomes. So whilst I'm sure most people don't bother with that kind of highfalutin language, if you could share some of the color that you encounter on the street from people who are opposed to killing others, but think the United States is the military light on the hill. That was obviously a great question.
I'll jump out with one of the challenges of grassroots organizing is remembering that we need to focus on the movable.
Yeah.
And the movable. So, you know, every 5, usually it's 20 minutes you waste in any kind of debate with someone who doesn't agree with us. You know, 10 people have walked by that would agree with us. And it'd be naive to think that in our short conversations with people, we'd be able to change anyone's entire worldview. That said, I have, in my 3 years of organizing, come to believe that there are 2 types of people in the world. The people who believe that there is a good guy and a bad guy. Usually America is the good guy, and usually they're the good guy too.
Yeah.
And then there's the people who believe that we all have the capacity for good and evil, and it's all decisions we have the choice to make. So for me, I feel like, you know, anyone who's ever... That said, I do feel like there's some progressives that kind of get a little wrapped up in this, oh, well, maybe we need it, you know? So there's that middle ground of people who, I need to walk back a little bit and walk back from the immediate situation of, like, say, the war in Iraq and whether or not we have to have troops there, because there's been a lot of really good reasons, a lot of different reasons given to why we should be there, including protecting women's rights. And it's of all...
especially with that Afghanistan, yeah.
Yeah, Afghanistan is something where it's hard...
With the women's rights thing, yeah.
Yeah, to not have, like, a sense of consciousness, and especially since in the 1980s we abandoned them after empowering them to defeat the Soviet Union. I think it's complex situations, and one of the challenges is that as an organizer in a short conversation, we're trying to wade through a really complex and multi-layered foreign policy. I like to step back and try to find the common ground with someone, because I believe that at the end of the day, if I could sit down with each of these people and have an hour-long conversation, I would find a lot of common ground and then be able to work forward through there and what kind of other options are possible. I think that's actually what works best with our organization is we don't deny that there is a security threat. We don't deny that there are security concerns and that there's things we need to address. But by putting forward actual options and alternatives, that's how we're able to get people who are clear thinking to come on board and be like, oh wow, I totally agree. Whether or not they would be at first hesitant because they feel like, oh, it's either this way or nothing, we provide that kind of alternative and get them engaged.
I try to really convey the concept that we are at a period right now where we are actually overreaching and therefore weakening our position in this chaotic Hobbesian system to these people. Seth talks about this. Our organization exists on two levels. On one level, we're saying counterinsurgency is stupid. You know, nation building is dumb. Counterterrorism is what actually is going to work to go after Al-Qaeda and the like. We're not huge fans of counterterrorism, but we recognize that if that's the dichotomy...
Thank you very much, sir.
Counterterrorism is the preferable option.
Okay.
And then sort of on a third level, it's this notion that, you know, what we have to do is pursue peace in all of our relations. And Seth was saying...
Seth Lair,
who's our development director, saying, you know, and that's only going to come about when we have equality in all of our relations, all of our economic, all our gender, all of our racial identity relations. So you kind of have to exist on that pragmatic level. And when I talk to somebody who's coming more from that masculine, how can we be the best father in the world kind of perspective, I tell them, well, you don't want to be an overbearing dad. You know, but right now we're putting all of our resources into the belt and timeout, and we're not at all putting any of our resources into the candy bar. We're not putting any of our resources into some meal that we can give to people. And, you know, the candy bar is, you know, some humanitarian aid, you know, a reforming USAID. So it's not Bechtel and Halliburton doing the reconstruction, but it's actually, you know, the locals that we're attempting to help. And then, yeah, we have the stick, but the stick is going to be targeted. It's going to be cheaper. It's not going to put us in a position where we're creating more hatred. And you just kind of approach them on that level and just kind of crawl along. But we don't have much time for that out on the street. So the way I do that real quickly is if somebody says, I'm kind of on the fence, I don't want us to be weak, I'll say, well, we're spending $400 million a day. If you're on the fence, you should recognize that $400 million a day could go to a whole lot better here at home. If they latch onto that, then you just kind of lead them along that line and then try to get to an ask. But if they don't latch onto that, have a great day. We're out here building up support.
Have a great day and you move on.
And that's it.
Lately I've been asking people, well, how did you feel about the war in Iraq? And it brings up this whole wave of emotions.
Yeah, I like that one a lot.
And an opposition. And, you know, they've sold the war in Afghanistan as a much more complex issue. Especially maybe it was because Bush was in charge, so there was a lot more divisiveness. But I find that gets people to real. I feel that America is traumatized. You know, ever since 9/11, we've experienced a lot of horrific things. Even beyond that, past that. But we're at a point where even people who would like to see positive outcomes have a real skepticism that they're possible because these things are so complex. I mean, I witnessed 9/11 in person in New York, and so I think it was a very complex event. Everyone's reaction around me was very more analytical, and then we saw this rush to war coming from Washington, which, you know, I don't know. Well, I don't. That's a long story of how that all went down, but I think people. I remember living in New York during that time. It wasn't until 2 years after 9/11 that I started, and many people around me started to experience a lot of sort of emotions and what I'd call awakenings. And I believe that we were even recovering from the physical trauma of that event and having experienced that event. I think that there's a lot of that in our society right now, and it's hard to make sense of.
John, can I ask you about that 9/11 thing? It's such a running sore, and I don't mean that in a trivial way, for so many of us, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, certainly. I mean, it's become like this pivotal moment in history, you know, where were you at 9/11, what was going on, and everyone has their story, and they remember it very, very clearly, you know. So, yeah, it's become a huge part of our history right now. I think... My opinion definitely falls in the same one as Francis is there, in that we did rush to war with a country when we were going after a terrorist organization that attacked us.
It's completely insane.
Yeah, and we did it out of fear. I mean, we're human beings. People get afraid, and we make not good decisions. That's what happens as human beings. And there's a bunch of human beings running our country. So that happens. You know, I think that ultimately, obviously, I think it wasn't a good choice ultimately. But I think right now we're at a point where we're 10 years into it. Even the people that are kind of on the fence ultimately want us to get out of Afghanistan. And everyone that I've talked to, I talk to people all across the political spectrum. I talk to, you know, Democrats, Republicans, you know, super progressives, you know, socialists, libertarians, everyone, and they all have different reasons for wanting to end the war, whether they think it's possible or not. But we're at a point in history right now where so many people can come together around this issue and really supply that unity and, you know, do this grassroots organizing that we keep talking about, you know, really talking, speaking with that clarity, with that solidarity, with a single unified message. And I think right now could be a very beautiful time in our history because of that.
Yeah. I'm just checking on time. We've got about a quarter of an hour left. I want to ask you guys in the remaining quarter of an hour about a couple of hot ticket items, hot button items we haven't discussed, but that are germane, I think. One is Israel, and the other is military families, which can, of course, intersect. I wondered how those things come up, if they do, in organizing that you folks engage in.
Well, military families, I've found to be a great source of support for us. You'll get the...
Introduce the soldier campaign?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing for me is the soldier tags. I mean, what basically, these soldier tags are, you study, you're involved in cultural studies, and I always think about when I was little, those little plastic toy soldiers that are used to militarize little boys for the most part. So those little plastic soldiers we attach to a slip. On one side of the slip it says bring them home, and that's where we attach the soldier. On the other side, people say we need to bring our troops home from basically stop the war in Afghanistan and bring the troops home because. And
they get to fill in their own personal message.
They get to fill in what that because is. And in the first week, I think may have been the beginning of week two, seventh day maybe of using these tags, I stopped a gentleman in Hollywood who was really in a hurry. He filled out the tag, and I looked at it real quick, and I saw on there it said, because my cousin died. And I said, I just looked up at him, and I was like, I don't know how to address this, but I mean, how do you feel? I essentially just let it, and he said, terrible. I don't want another person to be in a situation I'm in. And this kid was in a hurry, giving me no indication that he was going to stop and talk to me. I just did this because it was, he just showed interest a little bit. And I said, well, you know, we're out here every day fighting specifically so kids like your cousin who go in a lot of time for noble means or out of, you know, economic despair, so they're not sent, you know, to die in a war that's not serving their interests or serving the interests of the Afghan people for that matter. And then just gave him a pitch about the organization. He ended up signing up as a member. And I'm gonna say, just in my experience, that 30%, no, I don't know about 30, that's probably high, but I'd say 20% of the people I sign up as members, and that's either $20 one-time minimum or monthly sustainers, $10 minimum, are connected to the military in some way.
That's fascinating. And
the vast majority of them fall on our side, in my experience.
Yeah.
And it's because this is so disconnected for average middle-class Americans that a lot of these folks really feel that connection. That's why they want to get invested.
Casualty draft.
Yep.
Yeah. No, exactly. You know, from my perspective, like, we do run into military family, people who've been in the military every single day. We've had people canvas for us in the past that have come back from Afghanistan, from Iraq, and now want to do something against it. Want to work with us and work to end this war, because they've been there and they know what it looks like, you know, and we haven't seen it on television like we were seeing back in Vietnam.
Or even Iraq.
We don't know what it looks like. You know, when I encounter, you know, military families, people who have friends over there, you know, I have my personal story that I throw out there, which is, you know, there was a buddy of mine from college who went to Iraq and came back how many of years later and didn't have any, you know, anything physically wrong with him, didn't have anything mentally or emotionally wrong with him, but was like a completely different person. You know, just had the military training sunk into him, witnessed what he witnessed over there, and came back like not the same. You know, like I said, nothing psychological, nothing diagnosable, but was just a completely different guy. Completely had that militaristic mindset, and you know, this was a guy who joined the military because he couldn't keep paying for college.
Right.
You know, and he came back just with that.
I'll agree with you guys that, you know, there's definitely a lot of people who have family or have been in the military that have supported us. There is definitely a percentage of people who have family who, I wouldn't even say that they really stop and oppose us. They shut down in opposition really quick and won't talk to us. So there's that,
yeah,
oh, my
true.
Son's there. Bye. Yeah. You know, and
there
kind
that.
Of in an angry way. Yeah. So there's definitely, and of course, like, I mean, I feel like they come from a place of wanting to support their family, and I guess maybe they believe in the mission versus the people who support their family and don't believe in the mission and want to get them out quick.
And those ones seem to have talked to their family members who were over there a lot. The ones that support us are the ones that really talk to their family members often.
Yeah.
Their stories are vivid.
I sent up a girl whose mom had recently joined some sort of a program or organization that had been communicating with soldiers, and her mom started forwarding her this soldier's emails, and she actually read me an email that she had just received from this guy about just the horrificness he was experiencing, and then she signed up as a member, you know, because of that. So I think that when those personal stories are actually communicated and heard, and when people stop and really think about it, they tend to want to make a difference.
I thought the way that you talked about people's relationship to America, to patriotism, they personalize it. You said the good and evil. Mm-hmm. America's good. I'm also good.
Right.
the opponents are evil. The people we're fighting are also evil. You'll get people who have family that are involved in the military that aren't willing to give up that pride that they're on the good end of it. And those are the ones that we don't even talk to them. They'll say my family's over there and shut down real quick. But the ones that accept a gray area, it's almost universal. They come to our side and they want to be involved in what we're doing because they see us as allies and soldiers.
And what about Israel?
You notice the
big grins.
Well, if you don't, you know, I don't. I'm Larry King of the podcast, right? I don't want to nail you to the wall. And if you don't want to answer things, that's absolutely fine.
So it's actually one of the other instances that I've found people shut down really quick.
Yep.
Even people who are completely with us on every other issue.
Yeah.
And mind you, our organization is in our messaging, I would say, is nuanced. And we don't necessarily talk about Israel on the street at all. And our organization, doesn't present as extreme views or push that agenda.
It's so visceral.
Because it is, I think it is one of the most complex issues, and it's not something we want to, again, we work on what we can actually move, so we focus on things that we can move. But in our, say, congressional scorecard for the 2009, there are a couple, the Goldstone reports are listed as votes the Congress took that we were in opposition to. And I know Goldstone has gone and retracted some of what he said.
Well, he has partially retracted, but partially. The other signatories have not.
And that's something that just is listed there. And so,
can you explain what the congressional report card is, Francis?
Yeah. Yeah. So every year our organization compiles, our political team compiles a little pamphlet of various foreign policy related issues that Congress has voted on, including the voting record of every congressperson in the House and in the Senate. And it's a good way for us to educate the public on what Congress is actually voting on. And so it's something we give to our members every year, and when people sign up on the street, they get a copy right then and there. But, you know, the Goldstone votes, which were just our Congress basically denying the validity of his report without even requesting another report, which I always thought was kind of weird, like that they would say, like, that's wrong, but we're not going to do anything else. So kind of a, you know, I don't know, pretty benign, I think, kind of thing.
In my opinion, very benign.
People will see that mid-conversation, they will see that and they will shut the conversation, they will stop and walk away.
Completely.
You know, and the same thing with, actually, the scorecard prior had some votes about Iran and how we felt like unilateral gasoline sanctions were unproductive at affecting the regime. But, and we were, you know, critical of the what seemed like a drumbeat towards war with Iran. And people would see Iran and anything positive to do with Iran or not, and would stop and end the conversation and walk away and would refuse to continue.
The great story I have on this score is the, as they call themselves, Persians of Southern California in Orange County.
Tarantulas.
Precisely. Wanting to endow a particular University of California campus, not the one that I'm on, with massive amounts of money, and they have done so, but as a quid pro quo, wanting to have a gigantic naked golden statue of Bashar.
Oh, wow.
At the entry point to the campus. Fantastic.
Well, and I guess I'd also throw out is the research objective. In that same shutting off of the conversation, the people who don't necessarily completely shut off will always want to go do more research, and which I understand. They want to see where our organization falls on these issues. And even actually some Persians will want to go do more research. And I would love for them to go do more research. We just, as canvassers, know that I want to go do more research.
Doesn't mean you've got a signature.
doesn't mean they're actually going to go do more research.
Yeah.
I hang out with a lot of canvassers, and we'll instead of saying no to each other sometimes, we'll actually say, I'm going to just go ahead and do some more research on that.
right. It's a training thing.
Yeah, I'm still eating.
But it's actually, the thing is, not to make fun of that, because it is a genuine objection. Oftentimes people who have every intention to go sign up, there's just the issue of living your life.
No, sure, I understand and I appreciate it. I guess I'm thinking that we often say Social Security is the third rail of U.S. politics, but Israel is also a third rail, I think, in lots of ways. And it's changing, but it's still a big issue. And I think that it's complicated for an organization like Peace Action West, at least for me as an outsider, because the issues that you're focusing on, although they have an impact on Israel and an impact on the Arab world in general, are not articulated specifically to the Palestinian struggle, to Zionism, to Israel, to the Holocaust, all those hot button you know, very complex issues that are addressed by this. And yet, my sense is that there are lots of people for whom Islam means the Arab world, and somehow or other, Iran is included in that, as is a significant proportion of the Israeli population. And that population is anti-Semitic, and we're not anti-Semitic. And this is the great stain, along with slavery, in our past as Euro-Americans, and we're not going to allow it again. Right? That's flowing around the traps.
Yeah.
And similarly, another issue, this relates to the military families question, is that one of the mantras in the mid-60s, when the anti-war movement, in terms of the American war in Vietnam, was gaining force, was the old song, The Universal Soldier, which went, "The universal soldier, he really is to blame. You know, you're still the one who loads the gun and fires. I don't care about the poverty draft. I don't care about the draft. You're still killing." It seems to me both these issues are very complicated, right, for Peace Action West.
Yeah.
Maybe internally, but externally as well. You cannot be saying, I suspect, Israel is part of the welfare state of the U.S. and the military state of the U.S. And you cannot be saying, it seems to me, the U.S. military at a personal, human level, individually, is partially culpable. You have to step back from that. I'm not asking you guys to endorse or contest my opinion, but as an outsider, it seems to me these are very important questions that can't be spoken about. The peace movement made a decision in 2001, 2003. It was not going to talk about Israel. It was not going to talk about the responsibility of people in the military. It was going to withdraw comprehensively from the anti-military personnel ethos of the 60s through to the late 70s.
I personally engaged in counter-recruitment work. Bill O'Reilly led in with a picture of my white suburban middle-class face on an episode of the O'Reilly Factor, screaming at a military recruiter on San Francisco State's campus.
This is on Fox News channel.
Fox News, Bill O'Reilly, had a whole piece on the anti-American, anti-soldier, anti-war movement. all those antis added up to "I hate the soldier," essentially. And I was out there essentially protesting the lies that the recruiters were engaging in at the time. It was 2006-07, basically the point where military recruitment was at its all-time ebb. I personally, on a lot of levels, endorse your understanding of the universal soldier, but as an organization, we have so much more power by taking the side and understanding where these soldiers are coming from. Poverty draft, false notions of what their patriotism is, and it is absolutely essential for us that we have that framework, pro-soldier, anti-war machine, in real crass terms.
Yeah.
With Israel-Palestine, it's so visceral, it's so good evil. Most people who have opinion on it don't take the gray perspective, and we just kind of have to stay away from it in a lot of ways.
Well, I guess one reason that I love Peace Action West is that our mission statement is, you know, to advocate for a foreign policy that amplifies our best values. And again, I think people, if I could sit down and talk to them long enough, we'd arrive at a similar place. And I think there's a lot of it's hard to get to that place, and who has the time and the ability to wade through that kind of complexity? We take up different sides, Iran. But I mean, I guess that's one thing I throw out, is that, you know, I do believe that there is some way we could find common ground, and that's something Peace Action West has done a really great job of, bringing people from all sorts of different perspectives
together.
To address things that we can't address.
You got John, a libertarian, and I'm a dyed-in-the-wool socialist.
Absolutely.
Can I ask you about the best venues, John? Can I ask you about best venues? The phrase that was just used.
Best venues?
Best values.
Best values. Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, to me, like, my best values and the best values of the American people are, like, a smart, achievable foreign policy that's not violent. You know, talking about a lot of these soldiers, I mean, we've got you know, we've got overpaid people in suits up in Washington making the decisions of who's going to go where and what they're going to do, and they're asking these people to make a ridiculous sacrifice. They're asking these people to make sometimes the ultimate sacrifice, and asking that of poor people, of someone else's son, without having something substantial to back it up, without having a really good solid reason, to me is ridiculous. You know, it has become Vietnam all over again. You know, they're sending other people's kids to die so that we can take a hill and the Taliban takes it back the next day. So to me, that's why I can support the soldiers, why I can support these kids, because I want them, if they're going to make that kind of sacrifice, to have it be an efficient sacrifice, a good sacrifice, and, you know, a sacrifice that's worth making. And right now it's not.
Well, listen, thank you very much, guys. It's been wonderful talking to you. Very inspirational. I feel as though, thank you, sir. I've learned a lot more about the anti-war movement, about Peace Action West, and about canvassing. And I want to invite you all back into the pod when war is over. And I, in my John Lennon way, will cut my hair and get out of bed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.